namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So with the opportunity to permission of the Sangha and with respect to the visiting monks and bhikkhuni and also to Excellency, the High Commissioner, who's come to this event. This is quite a auspicious event. Ajahn Vidhamo said this is the most the biggest event he's had so far here. And of course, it's always seen the interest in the Dhamma and the teachings of the Buddha spread into Western countries over the past 50, 60 years. It's always very encouraging because the Buddha's teaching is a wisdom teaching. It's about seeing things, knowing life, and recognizing the reality. So it's an awakening teaching. It's not about conversion or conditioning you to become anything, but to awaken the human consciousness to ultimate reality, to the truth, which is in this tradition called Dhamma. And so this is the Visakha Puja Day, so you have three events: birth, enlightenment, and death, all celebrated on one day. It was the Buddha actually born on the full moon of May, enlightened on the full moon of May, and died on the full moon of May. And of course, to a Western mind, which is based on we believe in history as our reality, this seems impossible. But in terms of a reflective teaching, this is very valuable because, of course, we've all been born already, so that's why we're here. So that part of this is over. Now enlightenment is between those two events. So the future is death, and in between birth and death is the opportunity that the Buddha made available for awakened consciousness within the human form. And so this is, even though it's an ancient teaching, 2,553 years ago, from India, it's based on the universal reality. So it's not just culture-bound kind of religious teachings that are stained or perverted or changed by antiquity, but actually the reality of the Buddha's teaching is even more apparent at a time like this in countries like Canada. And I became first interested, my first encounter with Buddhism was I was in the U.S. Navy during the Korean War and in Japan, so I encountered Zen Buddhism there, and just as it was being kind of, there's a cultural exchange taking place between Japan and the United States, that was one of the good things that came into the consciousness of the Americans was Zen Buddhism, as it was translated into English, and it became quite a fashionable or even faddish event at that time in the San Francisco Bay Area, and that was the home port for our ship. So I was on a cargo ship carrying supplies from the West Coast to the American bases in Japan at that time. What inspired me about it, what interested me, was the way that it operated, what it didn't demand belief. It was a way of looking, changing your perspective, getting a different view, rather than operating from proclaimed doctrines. Because my character, my personal character, is a skeptical one. So I was brought up in the Anglican Church in America, Episcopal Church. Very good, devout parents. But when I started thinking about it, I knew I didn't really believe it. And I couldn't, even with a kind of willful determination to believe. But you can't, I couldn't do it. I couldn't make myself do that. Where the Buddha didn't expect that or demand that, because his teachings are based on universal truths, on reality, on the way things are, not on a set of doctrines that we have to accept. And that some people can, with no problem, others of us cannot. My mother was a devout Catholic, and she never had any problems with skepticism. And she totally baffled me, because I had from very early age. So this skeptical nature has its own advantages in the fact that it does bring us to question life. What are we here for? What is the purpose? What is the meaning? In some ways, when we just try to analyze it and criticize it from Western attitudes, Western philosophies, we either have to accept it in terms of a Jewish or Christian perspective, or we get into skeptical doubt and into even annihilation attitudes of that there's no meaning, no purpose, just eat, drink, be merry, for tomorrow you'll die anyway. Or is there, what is the purpose of being human? What is there any advantage in it, or is it just an accident, a big bang event that happened to be coincidental and we just appeared out of a surprising collection of atoms that come together at some remote time, and here we are. Well, these are unknowns. You can't really, you can speculate and play with the statistics and the facts. But the reality is that right now, at this very moment, we don't know. And that not knowing then is doubt. It leaves us in a state of suspended thinking when we try to know everything through thoughts, through perceptions, through language, through views, through opinions. Then we bind ourselves to already formed views that have been given to us. And what the Buddha, the unique quality of the Buddha Dhamma is the emphasis on mindfulness. This word mindfulness, or in Pali Sati Sampajanya, this is a word, even though we translate it into English as mindfulness, we don't really, it's not part of our cultural demand or expectation. It's becoming increasingly so. Like I find in England now, the psychotherapists are talk about mindfulness all the time. But 20 years ago, the word was never used. So maybe Buddhism is having an effect, an influence of some sort. But this the Buddha made very clear, this mindfulness, this ability to be fully present, open to the present moment, is the what they call the gate or the path to the deathless reality. So, the deathless reality is, what is that? And then when we try to describe a concept such as deathlessness, you can't do it. It leaves your mind blank. You go into a state of don't know or uncertain. You can imagine a kind of other realm, a kind of place where you live forever, as an immortal soul or something. But the fact is, at this very moment, at this here and now, between birth and death of our bodies, is the ultimate reality. And so the Buddha is awakening, is this sense of awakening to it. So mindfulness is a human gift, the human ability that we have as mortal forms with our conditioning, with our emotions, our views and opinions and all the rest, at this very moment, what we share in common is this deathless reality, which we can't describe, but if this was not present, then we wouldn't be here. So the Buddha made it very clear that mindfulness was this gate or this door to the unconditioned, unborn, uncreated. He used words like the Nibbana or Anatta, these Pali words that are more like negations of conditioning rather than descriptions of anything. So they're not defining with characteristics, with qualities, but if you notice the negation, you can't imagine what is unimaginable. So you can imagine all kind of forms, shapes, colors, all possibilities, you know, refined course. But unimaginable is impossible, but we can be aware. Awareness puts us into this intuitive presence here and now, in which our reflective ability or discerning ability to discern, or in Buddhist terms, the panya, ability to discern reality from illusion. And so the Buddha gave a very clear teaching after his enlightenment, in the legendary story after enlightenment, his first thought was, this is impossible, there's no way you can teach this, so I won't even bother. And then the Brahma god Sahampati came and said, please, for the welfare of those with only a little dust in their eyes. So this was the Buddha's invitation by the gods to go forth and teach, because there are those. In other words, the human being and human consciousness allows us this same kind of experience of enlightenment or awakening to reality that the Buddha had. So, you know, if Buddha was some kind of ethereal being or special kind of God, that we wouldn't be able, we might adore and admire and worship, but his teaching is not about himself. He wasn't going around pointing to himself as some kind of realized being that one should worship. But in his first sermon, he gave very clear teaching, what we call the Four Noble Truths. And now in my own monastic life, this is the teaching I've used for my investigation of the reality as I have to experience through this form. And of course, this was Ajahn Chah's emphasis. We all had to memorize and chant the Tamajakapavattana Sutta, the first sermon of the Buddha, as, you know, in Pali. And then in our own life, our daily life in the monastery was to internalize, not just to have rote memory and be able to chant, but actually to develop an awareness and an investigation of our lives, of ourselves as we're living in the monastic form, as we did at Wat Pa Nong Pa Pong in Ubon in Thailand. So this was a teaching that was based not on any belief, but the most banal, common human experience that we can all relate to on dukkha, or translated generally as suffering. Now dukkha is is what most people are trying to get rid of. And we think, what's noble about that? You know, and when you go to interfaith meetings in London, all the other theistic religions tend to say, you know, our God is about love, and your Buddha just teaches suffering, because that's how it sounds. Because when you really look at the way the Buddha presented this teaching, it wasn't from a metaphysical position, but from the most ordinary experience common to every creature, in fact, not just humanity, but all creatures. Dukkha is a noble truth. And so it doesn't mean that it isn't a pessimistic proclamation that life is just misery. It's a very positive statement of reality, that this changing conditioned realm that we're experiencing is like this. Birth is the cause of death, and old age and sickness. You know, everybody that's born grows up, gets old, gets sick, and dies. And that sounds pretty grim, but in terms of personal desires for happiness and eternal life, but it is pointing to the common reality that we all share, whether we're rich or poor, male or female, or whatever. This is a common bond that we can all relate to. But it's a noble truth because it isn't that in itself a noble, you know, suffering isn't noble, but it's a noble truth because to really understand suffering, we have to look at ourselves rather than blaming it on others, on conditions external to us. And so that's a sign of nobility. To me, the English word noble is, there's something noble in a human being that starts seeing the suffering as something within themselves rather than blaming it always on the weather, on the dear flies, on the mosquitoes, on the government, on your husband or wife or children. It's about understanding, willing to look at your own fear or anxiety or worry or anger, greed and confusion that are common to all of us. And so we're changing from just trying to avoid and get rid of our way to looking, to understanding, to noticing, to change the attitude of running away or blaming, or resigning ourselves just to a misery in a negative way. It's a positive embracing of suffering, of the nature of the body, of the conditioned realm, because conditions are in this inexorable changing state. You can't keep anything, happiness for very long. It reaches its peak and then it changes. Or youth and beauty and all the best, security, seeking security in governments or in social conditions or ownership of things always has its negative side also. Things are uncertain, unsatisfactory. That's the very nature of this realm. And the second noble truth is that there are the causes of suffering, the origins of it. So it's not an ultimate truth. Dukkha is a noble truth, but not ultimate reality. And so then the investigation of the causes is through beginning to recognize our own ignorant grasping, our desires that we identify with, the way we are conditioned to react according to our cultural conditioning or personal karma. We begin to see that desire or dunha is something we all experience. It's this realm that we live in is a desire realm. These human forms are desire forms. You know, we wouldn't be here if there is no desire in us. And so, so then the sense realm, we're incarcerated in a human form for a lifetime, from birth to death, in a form that is changing. And we have senses, we have eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body. All they, and we have a retentive memory. So we are constantly being impinged on by the objects of the senses, being irritated or tempted or repelled by what contacts our senses. So heat and cold, hunger, thirst, beauty, ugliness, all the rest. It's just this realm. This realm is a sense realm. It's about birth and death. It's about suffering and change. And the Buddha then is pointing to this reality. He's not judging it and say it shouldn't be this way. He's not blaming God or anyone else for it. He's just pointing, say, wake up to this. This is what you can actually know in a direct way. And through this knowing, we have the insight into letting go of suffering, letting go of the causes, letting go of desire, not annihilating, not destroying anything, but out of discernment, out of wisdom, we see the suffering we are responsible for through ignorant attachment to desire. And so the advice the Buddha gave is to let go of desire, which leads to the third one, the end of suffering or the cessation. Now these are all witnessed through your, don't wait until your dying moment. I mean, these teachings are here, you know, for 2,553 years already, so it's not like New Age kind of philosophy. it's meant to awaken us, to put them into, to investigate, to look into, to get to the root cause. And in my experience with the Lumpur Chans and the Thayajans in northeast Thailand, were very much, they were always, when I first went to live with Lumpur Cha, I couldn't speak Thai. And so, you know, I did have problems in adjusting. the first month I was there, there was one monk who could translate for me, who knew English, but he didn't stay there. He left, so then I was on my own. So I had to deal with learning another language, which I found, you know, is a very different kind of language than English or French or European languages. So you have to use a different, you know, the tonal language. So you find you have to develop a different kind of sense for it than you have to have when you're speaking English. And then learning to fit into a very conservative form. Like I chose Lumpur Cha because he was the most strict Vinaya teacher at the time. And I'm from very hedonistic West Coast California background. And so I've lived in Berkeley for several years in the early 60s. And of course everything was wide open for just seeking pleasure, fulfilling all your desires. And this kind of open door towards seeking happiness was so strong there. You know, and then going to live in the most conservative forest monastery in northeast Thailand. Why did I do it? Sometimes I used to wonder myself. But anyway, there's something in me knew that this is what I needed. You know, there's a kind of an internal sense that just living a hedonistic life, I could tell, was not the way I wanted to live. And even though it had its pleasures, those pleasures did not lead onward to anything other than more kind of desires. Where the living within a structured form like the traditional Vinaya in the Pali Canon, I chose that because I wanted to live in a discipline that I had no control over, that I didn't make up, or I couldn't convince anyone to change, you know. So you're kind of, I wanted to see what would happen, you know, because I am a personally quite a, have a manipulating personality. So it, and I knew that if I just allowed that to take place, that I wouldn't go very far. So I put myself in a very strict environment, but I also had a great sense of respect for Ajahn Chah. At that time, I lived, you know, in over a year in Thailand before I met him. So I met many, many masters, many highly regarded monks. But it, somehow when I met Lungpa Chah, it was like intuitively, I just knew there was no point in looking any further. So I stayed with him for 10 years. And during those 10 years, Ajahn Viradhamo joined me. And we have many sentimental, nostalgic stories of life in the forest monasteries with Lungpa Chah. But he did present an opportunity that I'm forever grateful for, because in that monastery, his whole emphasis was on mindfulness. The Vinaya was for mindfulness. The way we lived our lives, the customs, the whole monastic form was not just an end in itself or just kind of, this is our tradition and you have to do it this way, because the whole point was to give up one's own kind of manipulative tendencies to just do it in this agreed and simple way. And then I found life quite easy, actually. Because it wasn't about competition or you know, trying to, you know, follow my own wishes or jealousies of others, but beginning to really look at myself. And because I was in a kind of structure that was, that I didn't manipulate, and that we all agreed upon, the monastic form was agreed upon, and so we lived according to that way. Of course, it did, you know, I did suffer a lot. But the way Lungpa Chah kept pointing, he said, he would point to his heart, and he said, like, look at your mind. And so, during those, you know, even when I was not really skilled in understanding the language, I didn't get the point quite quickly, you know, and he points here. He wasn't pointing to himself as a person, but it's a gesture, isn't it, of you look in, at yourself, you look at your heart, or in Thai say, dujai, like this. So then even when I found some of the rules and personal relationships irritating, frustrating, and you know, and the Americans were very conceited as a culture anyway, so we always think we know better and better ways of doing things. And of course, eventually I began to see this, you know, as a condition, cultural conditioning. And then I just decided, well, if I live here, I'll do it their way. That's it. They're not asking me to do anything wrong, and maybe I think I know of a better way, but they're not interested. I'll do it their way. Well, life was much more easy than me always trying to you know, improve, progress, and develop. This is American way of life, isn't it? Making everything better. Well, it's almost going to the opposite of what someone like myself was culturally conditioned to do. You know, when you're an alms mendicant, you know, I didn't quite sink in at first what that really meant. And then I realized that by becoming a bhikkhu, I had become, you know, given up all my rights. I couldn't have money, couldn't dig in the soil, couldn't go to the supermarket and buy food. I had to have everything offered and strict celibacy and not any kind of sexual involvement of any sort with intention, giving up all my rights as an American citizen. To live in this way, you know, and dependent on the kindness of others, you know. So you're just totally dependent on the four requisites: food in the alms bowl, robes to wear, shelter for the night, and medicine for sickness. And they were strict in what Bob Pong about that. So you know, it there was no kind of way out of it. And then I was brought up in the other way, to be independent, self-assertive, to be competitive, to always seek ways of making your life secure, not to be dependent on others. The kind of cynical attitude that human beings are basically selfish, and you've got to think of yourself first. This was my cultural background and conditioning. And then what Numpa Cha said was that human beings are basically good. And so when I had doubts about going to live in England, about how I could live as a Buddhist monk keeping the Vinaya in a city like London, you know, I thought that I just don't, you know, I began to have these anxieties about going there. So he said, well, are there good people in England? And I said, not being English, I wasn't sure. But I assumed there were. So I've been living there 34 years now with no problems. There are lots of good people in England. So, I mean, so we've survived on the on alms alms in a non-Buddhist country. Now that really impresses me over the years, because it goes against all the kind of cultural attitudes that were instilled in me when I was a child, you know, from babyhood on up. The attitudes that you acquire, cultural, social identities and conditioning. And awakening to Dhamma, to reality itself, was not easy, even though I understood the concept, but the ego, the sense of myself, the strong conditioning that one acquired after birth was so powerful, and reinforced by society itself. So I found living in with somebody like Ajahn Chah very beneficial, because he had broken through those illusions. So he saw the here and now through wisdom rather than through cultural perceptions or his own personal tendencies. Well, those kind of people are, you know, I'd never met anyone like that before. And so when I met him, I determined to stay with him as long as I could. I thought some of it might rub off on me. At least it was better than going back and living the life I was leading, where, you know, it was just taking me into an endless pursuit of distracting events of seeking happiness and excitement, romance and adventure. So living a life in a forest monastery in northeast Thailand, it was pretty boring much of the time. But that was very, very much a part of it, to be able to it gives you that opportunity, that encouragement to look at your mind and to not see it in terms of criticism of whether it's right or wrong, but all conditions are impermanent. You're looking through the discerning ability, which Buddha made very clear. A statement, all conditions are impermanent. Sape sangharani cha is a Pali phrase. And so that means, you know, whatever the conditions are, good and bad, right or wrong, our relationship to them is awakening to their characteristic, their anicca, dukkha, anatta, they're impermanent, they're unsatisfying, and they're not. There's no permanent self-entity in any of them. So then that which is aware of those conditions, you know, the awareness, the mindfulness of conditioned phenomena, that's the way, that's the gate to the unconditioned. It's through that that we have perspective on birth and death, on the changing nature of conditioned phenomena, both internally and externally. So it's very good to see here at this seemingly remote place in Canada. Ajahn Vaidheva has kindly, and Rajan Kusilo and other monks have come here to establish this place, see it as a place to, you know, a geographical location where you can come to be reminded, because in our daily lives we forget. And modern life is a life, you know, of stress, and modern life in Canada is probably that much different from England, but it is, there's so much pressures and speed and high tech and distraction attacking us, and opportunities for indulging in endless distractions are now possible in a way that never existed before. So I noticed in Amaravati is outside of London, about 25 miles out of London in Chiltern Hills. So it's quite a nice area, but people say they like to come there just to get away from the stress of their lives in cities like London or Luton or Birmingham, or the cities that we draw from. Also, it's see it as a reminder, you know, to come and collect yourself, to center yourself, to get inspiration or to get encouragement, to develop our lives in whatever way we have to live them, according to the teachings of the Buddha. Because those teachings aren't a matter of believing, they're just very, very skillful means towards encouraging awakened consciousness with wisdom, so that we can see for ourselves. These Four Noble Truths are provable. They're not just theoretical ideas or concepts that are impossible for any of us to know other than just quote them. They're about our lives, about you and me, about being in a human form, about getting old and sick, about loss. We all have to experience loss in our lives, loss of parents, of teachers, of friends. Death and separation is part of every human lifetime. We all, you know, this is, and this Dhamma teachings prepare us for these events so that we're not just helpless victims of fate as it might seem otherwise, but we actually learn and grow and develop wisdom through awakening to life and understanding it in this way. So on this Visakha Puja day, this is your occasion for awareness. And that's the point of enlightenment, where before the death of the body. And so this, we have the, you know, I'm getting to the end of the body's wearing out. But this practice, you know, years of having this opportunity as a Buddhist monk to practice in this way is such that I'm forever grateful to the Buddha, because it is, you know, it actually is something you can prove to yourself. It's not just a good idea or an interesting philosophy. Even though it's both of those, it's much more. And it's and then, of course, the attitude of bhavana. Like today, we had the dana and the sila, like the offering of alms, and then the taking of the precepts, and then bhavana is the third one. This is bhavana is really awakening to reality. It's when we really awaken and use and develop and cultivate mindfulness in our lives that we can see for ourselves. This is the escape hatch from birth and death, from suffering and greed, hatred, and delusion. In my own life, being a Buddhist monk, you have all kinds of opportunities. Some people think that Buddhist monks live in an ivory tower, and that we're just living here at Tisarana, always in a state of bliss. But that's not the case. If human existence, relationships with others, whether they're in monastic form or not, there's always conflict and disagreement and change from outside, from inside. And so these are, rather than trying to make everybody peaceful, you know, really encourage them to awaken to see the causes of suffering, so that we learn from our experience of life rather than just try to control it and make it to fit some ideal of what we would like it to be. In one's own life, the attempts in the previous century to create perfect systems of government, you know, of communism and whatnot, that would, were based on ideals of how things should be: equality, shared wealth, and no rich, no poor, everything in common. This was an ideal, you know, and it collapsed because, you know, an ideal is one thing. We can create ideals in our heads, you know, so that's, they're all quite, can be quite good at knowing how things should be. But really observing the way things are, this is what mindfulness allows us to do, about having a human body, living with the people we live with, in the society we're in. We're not trying to control or manipulate the conditions, but learn from our own karmic tendencies, reactions, and habits in regards to the environment, the relationships we have with others, and the country that we live in, plus the limitation of being a human individual. Human beings suffer a lot from kind of hubris, this disease of overestimating oneself. We do try to pretend we're like deities. You know, we're much better than the beavers or the raccoons. And we put on airs of superiority and advancement. And so we easily, because we have an intelligent mind, so we can create scenarios of superiority that are quite believable. But in terms of mindfulness, that doesn't compute. We see, you know, the self view as an affliction, if one is bound to it and limited by that, rather than thinking, because I'm so conceited, I think, like Devadatta in the play. That's an example of many human problems, is I know better than anyone else. But this is also can be seen, the suffering of conceit and whether one goes to the other extreme. I don't know anything. I'm just a hopeless case. I've been meditating for 20 years and still don't have samadhi. I'm not a very good Buddhist. That's also conceit. So there's conceit, and, you know, taking it to its most one extreme of I'm the best in the world, or I'm utterly hopeless, and then all the permutations are in between those two extremes, it's conceit. And so by recognizing conceit, knowing it, is not thinking we shouldn't be conceited because that's another conceit, but observing it and the suffering we create through attachment to this limited self-perception. We let go of that. Then we are aware of Dhamma, of reality, in which then we have that perspective on the conditions that we have to experience in our life till the death of the body. We have perspective gives us, you know, it is a way of looking at life where we're not just helplessly bound and limited into the conditioning that we've acquired. And so this Ajahn Vaidarbha, he's also was with Ajahn Chah for many years and helped me establish Wat Pat Nanachat and Titthurst and Amaravati. You must be getting tired of this. he is a kind man. And I'm retiring, and I've announced my retirement as a bhikkhus can't retire. But I'm going to anyway. And that doesn't mean I'm disrobing, but I've been involved in establishing monasteries for so many years, and I don't want to establish any more. And the ones I have established are quite kind of have their own momentum. I'm no longer necessary to hold it together. So I feel this great sense of freedom and lightness of being through realizing that what I entered the monastic life for was to live a nice, peaceful life away from people. I actually wanted to be a hermit. And then fate would have it otherwise. I get thrown into these leadership positions and see what happens, whether I can, if my karma will allow me any peace in my old age on level of non-involvement. But the real peace is in here, in the jitta. And though when Lungpan Cha kept pointing at his heart, at a do jit kind of practice, that's where you find that stillness. And as you begin to recognize it, you cultivate stillness wherever you are, whether the conditions are favorable, you know, and beautiful and pleasant, or cacophonous, noisy, or whatever. Once you recognize that and know it, then that's real bhavana. You cultivate from that. So it doesn't matter particularly, you know, the conditions around you are no longer the important issue, because you're finding your deliverance, your liberation from within, rather than trying to control the environment without, which will always lead to endless frustration, I guarantee. So I wish you all the best, and happy Visakha Puja Day, and I appreciate Ajahn Vaidarbha inviting me here, and so I'm quite glad to help in any way that I can, but not to come and be the head monk here.
Handmayang vada kata satu karang tatamose satu satu satu. Sato Anamodhami.
Okay, so thank you, Lumpur. So the one remaining scheduled event is Kuti Tours. For those of you who want to go for a walk around the monastic area, there's really only a couple, two or three of the Kutis there that you can have a look at. They're quite open. So if for those of you who want to do that, if you just gathered out in front of the house, the central circle there, and I guess we'd divide up into groups or whatever, you can go for a walk. Those who don't, you're most welcome to enjoy the property. You can go for a walk on your own out to the beaver pond, out to the wetland out there, or just around here, have a cup of tea, have a drink, whatever, just enjoy the remainder of the day. And before we disperse, we could just finish with the closing homage at the shrine and pay respects.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā Buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādemi Svakato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho sangham namami